to be. And then there's also been a lot of attention to MDR next year, very recently, with the release of the photos of James Noctway and the launch of the www.xdr.org website, as well as the announcement of the Beijing conference, the ministerial forum in April. So I think there's a big move to try to work together and strengthen the health systems in which we're functioning to move forward on MDR-TB control. So the question for today is really whether MDR and XDR-TB can also be a jumping off point for us to do some of that health system strengthening that needs to be done. And we are not going to talk about all of the health systems issues around MDR and XDR-TB today, but we are going to try to focus on some of the pertinent ones and some solutions as well as challenges, not only at the international global level, but also very much at the field level. And so I hope that these presentations and the discussion we have together will stimulate your ideas and your thinking about how we can innovate in TB control to address these issues and to strengthen the health systems in which we're operating. So without further ado, I will introduce our first speaker, Dr. G.B. Migliori,
who is the director of the
WHO Collaborating Center for Tuberculosis and Lung Disease in Trodate, Italy, as well as the current president of the IUATLD European region and the head of the tuberculosis section at the European Respiratory Society. But many of you in this room probably also know him as the ruler of the tiny kingdom of Fictitia. So, G.B.
Thank you very much, Darcy and Diana. Today, I'm just going to briefly present you the story of the development and the results of the testing of the MDR-XDR TB assessment tool. I want to take my time because I need to stay under 15 minutes. This has been funded by USAID, and this allowed both the development and the testing through PATH. Countries and consultants have two main problems. One is to develop adequate national strategies that should be also well conceptualized and planned, and also to develop GLENAD committee and global fund applications. And up to now, there is no standard methodology that allows collection of country-level data that are relevant for the assessment of the MDR-XDR situation and needs in countries, and also there is a deficit of trained evaluators and consultants. So the tool has been designed to answer two main questions. What can we do to prevent MDR and XDR-TB? That's the first question. And the second question is, if MDR and XDR are already prevalent in a given setting, what can we do to diagnose and treat adequately for the extent we can those cases? So those are the, let's say, users and uses the tool can be useful. First of all, for national staff. National staff are supposed to prepare national submissional plans for prevention and control of MDR-XDR. But then we have also the GLENAD committee or even Global Fund missions who need maybe to provide information, sometimes baseline information, against which to measure progress towards indicators. Then we have, of course, consultants who are asked to prepare applications to support technical countries to develop applications. Then we have agencies who are involved in TB technical assistance, and it's important to provide adequate standardized information to allow facilitate this process. And of course also donors that need to decide where to put their funding. The process used goes from collection of key data, for example indicators on treatment outcomes and drug resistance, then collecting information on contributing factors. So those are basically the elements of the strategy we are going to see in the next slide. Then there will be an analysis with identification of weaknesses and gaps within the program, and this is linked with the development of a report that links findings with recommendation and public health action. And then finally, the public health action that means to plan and then to request and organize technical assistance. The progress towards the development of the tool was pretty long and lasted a bit more than 1 year, with three versions of the initial version of the tool and four versions of the revised tool. There was a panel of experts that revised twice the tool. There was a review by the Green Line Committee. There was a preliminary field test and revision with a kind of desk review of a couple of countries. This was presented and discussed within the XDR-TB task force, then was piloted at country level, and then there was the final revision, so pretty long story. In terms of structure, it has two sections. First of all, the outcome data with that are aimed to answer the question one and two that we have just seen, and discussed with the country snapshot, reporting all the standard data available through the surveillance system. Then the performance data, treatment outcomes and drug resistance data, and then the data scoring, and I'll come soon to the story of the scoring. Then there is the contributing factor data with a set of scored and unscored questions that are built up on the six elements of the stop disease strategy. So as we have to start from somewhere, we thought to start from these six elements, because there is a large consensus on them, and everyone is familiar with them, so there was no doubt this was the ideal starting point. This is how the tool looks like. This is the initial scored questions for the first component, and the element A of the first component is political commitment. So there is the question, there are the possible answer with some explanation and one answer. There is the score, and I will come soon to how this has been built up. Then there is the possibility through the kind of answer that the user will give to identify weaknesses and gaps, and this is linked to action and recommendation. So if there is a gap, what can we do to improve the situation? And of course, to go to public health action. And here on the right, there is a space to comment and even to mention the data source, because this will be useful when once back after the mission or sometimes after to remember which document we have referred and so on. This is an example of unscored questions that are aimed to provide further information. And for each question, then there is a set of these unscored questions. And then there is a guide here to interpret the different scores to see whether the country has major problems or just some critical problems, some areas, or no major problems. The scores were evaluated in terms of feasibility and capacity to differentiate between different settings, for example, high and RTB prevalence or low prevalence countries, and this was developed through a Delphi process. I'll come to this soon. The scoring system, there was large discussion at the beginning, was aimed at identifying problematic areas. So it's mainly aimed to provide self-evaluation by countries, and is created by section only. So we didn't want the score used to create a score within countries, that this country is better than the other one. No, it's just by section. So should be used by countries to identify if they have, within the six elements, some areas of weakness. And of course, there is a link between the weaknesses and the public health actions through recommendation, request for technical assistance, and so on. And of course, there is a set of instructions that are accompanying the tool, allowing its use. The issue on how to develop the scoring system was pretty complicated, and through the help of several people, including Giovanni Soggio, that is just here, and I want to thank for that, we developed a Delphi process, that is a structured process that collects and distills knowledge from a group of different experts placed somewhere here and there in the world, and it's anonymous. Each expert was asked to assign a score, a priority, to the different questions that had been proposed by the previous versions, giving one to the highest, five to the lowest. So through that, all the scores were reweighted, recorded, with a value from 0 to 10. This is the reason why, according to this system, at the end we have some scores where a weight that is 10, others that have a weight that is 8 or 6 or 4. Depending on the priority, that's the panel of experts scale. Of course, this process allowed the tool to change its face several times during the process of development, and in particular, it was necessary to work on the component 1, 2, and 6 of the strategy because it was better, it was necessary to improve its capacity to better differentiate settings, and also to work on the components 3, 4, and 5 in order to proper, let's say, identify the weaknesses in the different settings. So these were the areas where the tool changed more over time. As a matter of fact, the number of scored questions decreased from 94 to 46, and several, other relevant questions were removed from the scored to the unscored. That, of course, increased up to 84. And even the printout size increased up to the present 60 pages, so it's a pretty big document, because this is aimed to be used over a Green Light Committee mission or something like that. So in our experience, it took from 3 to 5 days to complete it, according to the knowledge that the persons and the staff have of their own country. No more than 5 days, so that is the time of a mission. Here we see that we pre-tested it on 1 Western European country, 1 Sub-Saharan African country, and 1 Balkan country, and we had 3 versions of it. And we see that the 3rd version was much better able to differentiate the different totals, both as subtotal for the first component and for the sub-components. I don't want to go too much into details. And for example, the 3rd version was much better in differentiate, for example, the component of the political commitment or the component of monitoring and monitoring evaluation than the previous one. So we worked in the direction of improving the capacity to differentiate settings. Those are some of the pictures in the different countries of the work that we did. That's the surprise I said to the chairman. This was during field visit in one of the sub-Saharan countries in one health center. And of course we had to visit several different levels of, units, central level, intermediate level, and low level, peripheral, let's say, just to see how the tool works at the different in the different settings. This is a special thank to the fecticians, so the participants of the Sondal course, that is the October last year course and the May this year course. You see them in several moments, free time and the class. And basically, as fictitia is a well-defined country, but probably not so well-defined as a true one, then we used all the participants that were about 20 per training used the tool, applying it on fictitia. And then we measured the interpersonal variability in the answers to see how this worked. And there was improvement from the kit we have available in October and the kit we had available in May, with a small, let's say, variability between the different answers, among the different answers of the different people. So if this worked in fictitia, then it was a good sign that could have worked also in 2 countries. Those are the results in the different countries, and then I will examine them, area by area. So we had, of course, 1 Western European, 1 Balkan, 2 South African, and 1 Eastern European. And as far as the first component is, concerned, of course, we see that we have 2 problems here, in 2 countries, 2 settings in which some critical problems needing action were identified, not in the other areas. This for component 2 and 3, and we see that, for example, for component 2, to address the HIV and MDR and other challenges, we see that in 2 settings we have intermediate kind of problem and major problems were identified in the other Sub-Saharan African country. And we see that for the system strengthening, the Sub-Saharan African country here did pretty well, and the others had problems, including the Western European, because we know that sometimes the policies of the Western European countries are not meeting very well this specific item of the strategy. And those are the results of the other situations. For example, the Eastern European had some low score for all the components 4, 5, and 6, and also one of the sub-Saharan African countries here for component 5 and 6, and so on. And then, I mean, knowing which the countries are and knowing the story of the different problems, we see that this is specifically reflecting the true situation of the country. And there was positive feedback from the national and the NDP manager of the different countries. Which are now the next steps? To continue to gather users' feedback and then to come up with a final revision that is the one we are presenting now, that is based on the user's experience. This has been presented to the different components, to DONS, STOP-TB, Inline Committee, and so on, for adoption. This has been presented here in the symposium. It's absolutely free and available for use. And the idea now is to integrate it into a standard NTP review and planning process. So what we want to do now is to have even a kind of computerized tool. At the moment, it's not yet at that stage, that when you identify the gap, this immediately launch you the possibility to go to a recommendation in the report that can be then readjusted and used for planning purposes. And then yesterday, UNESCO asked me whether we can, that's we have to think about that, but create a kind of short version. ISTC kind of thing that for kind of quick and dirty use. I've been polite, I said, let's see what we can do, because I'm not sure we can do that, but maybe yes, we have to think about. So I want now to acknowledge all the people here that many of you, the majority of you are here in the room, that gave a significant contribution towards the development of the tool. And I want to thank also the donors who provided so much help and the financial possibility to do that, that is USAID. And finally, I want to remember those are the mail of Darcy and myself. We are available to share with you experiences and to send you the last version and share maybe the results of the use, because the process is seen as a continuous one. And then finally, I want to remind you that collaboration is always necessary if you want to avoid it. The wolf, that is the XDR bear, is going to eat the pigs. Thank you so much.
Thank you, GB. I think we have time for a couple of questions if people have any questions they want to ask right now. And while people are thinking about that, I just wanted to say a couple of other things. One is that for anyone who's interested in having a copy of the tool, they're sitting outside here, so feel free to pick one up. And if there are no more, I have an extra secret stash. And then the second thing is, in terms of the tool and its use, one of the things we are planning on doing with funding from USAID again is to develop some trainings for consultants and NTP staff on the use of the tool. So we're hoping that over the course of this year we will be able to tack on some trainings to some of the meetings that are already going on for the union regional meetings and for Cancun as well. So look for that if you're interested in using the tool. And also, GB and I are also available to help anyone who's interested in using the tool to kind of explain it. And when we say it's 60 pages, I don't really want people to be scared about that, because there's a lot of white space in the tool to be able to record your data in the field. So this is really meant for use in the middle of nowhere where you're not carrying your computer around, so you can write the notes in the tool. So if we really condensed it to an ISTC-type package, it would be a lot smaller.
Probably the next conference or event where the talk will take place probably will be Dubrovnik, where we will have next year, at the end of May, the regional, European regional conference, and there are pamphlets at the European region stand if you are interested. So we are still thinking and looking how we can organize this, but this will be probably the first training. And in Cancun, we are also developing the proposal right now.
Are there any questions? Everybody's still asleep this morning.
Early morning, in fact.
Okay. I will turn it over to Diana to introduce our next speaker. Thank you, GB.
We'll do a test on recall at 10 a.m., so please be prepared for responses to the tool. I think we're moving from a discussion on a tool, which is obviously essential for health system strengthening and capacity, to have those kinds of resources that are available in a structured fashion in low-income settings to both plan and to assess the quality of work going on and where to go next. And I just wanted to make a comment that I think what we've just seen is going to be absolutely essential in the coming months in the rather optimistic scenario of getting plans underway in some of the biggest, most complicated countries in the world, leading to a meeting in Beijing and in April on scaling up MDR, XDR, TB. So I think this tool, I mean, this is your prime chance to see, does it work in some of these countries? So that'll be very exciting. I have the pleasure to introduce now someone, Keshavji from Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital, who comes to us with a diverse background, I think in terms of regional experience is profoundly important, from a degree in anthropology and Middle East studies, his medical degree, launching with Partners in Health the work and following through in Tomsk and supporting good clinical practice in MDR care, engaging community health workers in that setting, and then now working also in Lesotho in a very different setting than Tomsk, and how to engage in health system strengthening, certainly in that setting alongside MDR work. And lastly, we say that we're very, very pleased as the Secretary of the Green Light Committee at WHO to have Salman as the Chair of the Green Light Committee, which, as we heard from GP, will be an essential group to be using this tool and in assisting countries. So Salman's going to be talking to us today about communities of practice for MDR care, and certainly that's when you think about networking for capacity building, where is one of the weakest, biggest constraints for health system strengthening broadly in developing countries is certainly around human resources and abilities to learn from others' experiences. So we're pleased to have Salman talk.
Thanks, Diana.
So we're going to switch gears from something that's you can carry around with you in the field that where you don't need a computer, to something where you do need a computer. I want to talk to you about GHD, Global Health Delivery Online Communities, as a means of improving drug-resistant TB management. So I've divided my talk into three sections. One is the whole issue about global health delivery, and then I'll talk a little bit about this online tool, which I think in different settings could have some very important uses, and then talk about online communities to improve management, the ones that actually exist. Are you guys hearing some feedback when I speak, or is it just me?
Yeah.
There he is. Okay, good. Maybe it was just my medication. Okay, so so gaps. So basically, when we think about it, when we look at any major global health delivery problem, and I'm not just thinking about TB. If you look at childhood deaths, maternal deaths, etc., we know that there are a lot of preventable deaths. And I think when we think about health system strengthening, the first thing we think about is not a computer tool. We often think about actual on-the-ground health system strengthening. But it turns out that if you start looking at some of these health problems, you can see that there are a lot of people doing new discovery. There are a lot of people developing ideas, developing models, developing plans. And these are supposed to feed into delivery, which ultimately gives you a successful health outcome. And so delivery is the way of tying together a lot of the discovery, development, et cetera. I mean, I'm sure all of us in this room have gone to many countries where we say, wow, this is a really good model. Why aren't they doing this kind of thing elsewhere? And I think the reason we haven't been doing these kind of things elsewhere is that our global health strategy to date is not one of sharing information. Now, obviously, everyone is here at 8 o'clock in the morning to share information, but in general. Is not one of sharing these models in a very sophisticated or orderly way. So projects generally are driven by donor preferences rather than current data. We look at RFAs, or we speak to project coordinators and say, what are you guys looking for, etc. And I think that the RFAs, the project coordinators, all of these things are driven by lack of knowledge about successful pilot programs, because a lot of these ideas that are taking place in many countries are not sufficiently disseminated. Also, there's competition amongst implementers. So people are trying to keep, they have certain ideas, they have certain ways of doing things, and there's no way to really share information between different implementers. And then lack of discussion about metrics. This morning we were discussing this evaluation tool, but there are a number of evaluation metrics, and I think that I speak for myself. When I joined the GLC, I learned about a number of metrics that I didn't even know existed. So I think that there's a lack of discussion about that. And when you think about MDRTB or DRTB in general, there are many pieces to this puzzle that a lot of us don't know. We don't have an in-depth knowledge about. So one is, you know, there's MDR-TB therapy. There's also this whole issue of drug supply management. There's issues about infection control and transmission interruption. There's a whole slew of information on public-private partnerships and what different people are doing in different countries that could be models for other parts of the world. Then, of course, training and, as we've seen already, monitoring and evaluation. So the idea would be, like, it would be really great if there was some sort of tool that could tie together the, you know, the research. There's innovation centers who are doing research, and hopefully the research is going to educate leaders. And if there was some other tool that could tie all of this together, where people could actually share information, it might be useful. And that's what GHD Online is. So the GHD Online attempts to answer the problem of information transfer for people in some of the world's poorest countries, and also people who are not in the world's poorest countries. It aims to provide people with information in one spot when they need it. It's a place where documents can be shared, and hopefully where we won't be trying to recreate the wheel. We'll see what other people have done in the areas that we work in. I'm going to show you a model of this. Now that I'm giving this talk, I'm thinking the slide should have probably been opposite. I should have shown you the model and then told you what it does, but it's... I can't change it now. So basically, the idea would be that this is a site where we can share proven practices, connect with colleagues, find resources, ask questions, and start discussions. And it can be a very powerful tool. So what constitutes a GHD community? So we've all been part of the web, and we know that you know, you can go to the web, and there's all these web communities. In fact, it's hard to log on. It's kind of, you know, difficult to coordinate through it, and it's it's not easy. And you look for information, and you find just a slew of information, and you're not sure what pertains to you, etc. So the idea, if you were going to create one of these communities, would be not to have that situation. You want a place where it's easy to use, and it's guided by some expert, because if you look at, let's say for example, an evaluation tool, you want to know, is the tool that we just saw better than evaluation tool X or evaluation tool Y? What do people think about it, etc.? So you want ideally to have a community that's guided by experts. Some people don't want public communities. So for example, the Greenlight Committee has a network of consultants. We're starting a community that's a private community because we want consultants who are going out to the field to be able to receive material, important reports, material, and ask questions within a closed community. So there's private communities. And then the communities can be multilingual. So the nature of the communities, while being very defined and with the aim to actually help people find information easily, it can also be broad. In the sense that you can have exactly a tool that you want. Right now, there's a talk, there's a session going on clinical trials. The MDR-TB Clinical Trials Group has a community. They have a closed community where they're working on protocols. So you can have very specific communities in different languages. So right now, there are a number of public global health delivery online communities. They deal with a number of issues. So there's one on adherence and retention that's run by Joya Mukherjee. There's one on TB infection control run by Ed Nardell. There's a drug-resistant TB community, and I'm one of the moderators for that, as is Irina Galmanova from Russia. And there's one on technology, which looks at IT issues. And then there are a number of additional communities. I told you about two of the closed communities, but there are other ones. The key thing is communities are not run by some central Uber computer guy somewhere. They're actually run by members. So it's not owned by an organization or an individual. So there are moderators that could come from different organizations. This initiative happens to be based at Harvard and is in Boston, but I mean, it could theoretically be anywhere. So what can you expect from GHD Online? So one of the things is that you can find global health content that you need in the area that you're interested in. So let's just say, for example, you're looking at transmission control, infection control. GHD Online has created a very special search engine. It's its own search engine. So if you go to Google and you type in infection control tuberculosis, I don't know what you get, Ed. You probably know better than I, but you probably get, 50,000 hits or 100,000 hits or something. What this does, or maybe even millions of hits, what this does is it actually takes those hits and it ranks them in a certain way. I don't think it even uses Google as its basis, but it's a search engine that ranks them in a certain way so that you actually get the most relevant hits first. And so it's a very powerful search engine for these communities. And because it's moderated also, things in the community are prioritized in different ways. I actually am not a computer person, so I don't know the algorithm. But trust me, it actually gives you back what appears to me to be the key material. The other good thing about this is that for people on the go, you don't actually have to log in. You can be part of this community and do stuff online. So if you are interested in anything that's new about infection control or everything that's new about something else, you can set up so that it sends you an email and it updates you on new things that are in your area. And so you don't have to log on to GHD. You just have to log on and set it to the email feature, and then it sends you stuff every week or every month, however you set it. Because it's an expert community and not just a general community, usually the communications that are coming from it are actually very useful. So basically, the tool that I'm about to show you allows you to add resources. So you can add annual reports, PowerPoint presentations, guidelines, etc. So again, I'm going to just go back to the infection control group, the transmission control group. All the latest guidelines can be there, and not just guidelines from one group. I mean, you can have the guidelines from the World Health Organization, and you can have the guidelines from, the American Thoracic Society, and a whole variety of people can be in a whole variety of documents can be in one spot. There's no storage limit, so for those of you who are saying, everything you've told us sounds like a Google group, it's a little bit more sophisticated than that because there's no storage limit, and as I'm about to show you, you can actually have discussions. So, and I've talked to you about the rest, the discussion, search, and email participation. So, I've already told you that you can have public communities and private communities. The private communities, for me personally, the private communities are the more powerful tool, because if it's nice to have everything in a public forum, but when you're working with a group of people across countries, it's very, very useful to have some instrument where you can share information. And we're finding this in the setting of the Greenlight Committee. We have, over 120 projects, and we have consultants going to all these projects. And there are lessons to be learned from each of them, but we need to have some tool to capture them, because if you don't capture what's happening, you really lose out. If you guys want to see a demo of this, by the way, the Sophie Bouvet is in the Eli Lilly booth, booth number 19. She's actually set up a computer so that you can see what I'm about to show you live. So this is it. This is the drama. This is the homepage. So you go to this website, and basically you can click on a community name to access its page. This is the general website. So at the top center, you can click on a community. So you can click adherence and retention or drug-resistant TB. You can, if you haven't signed in, this is what you see. So you can look at new discussions that are just general, recent activities. You can read news articles, etc. And then once you sign in, you go into your own community. So if you're a person that's interested in infection control, then you go into your own community, and when you read selected news and articles, it'll be the latest news and articles about your area. And it'll give you the opportunity to also post material. So let me show you. This is the actually general drug-resistant community website, where if you log into this, and anyone can join this, this isn't a closed community, you can send it, if you write to drtb at ghdonline, you basically write to everybody in the community. You can look at, you can contribute to discussions, you can access, like you can see at the bottom there, principles of outpatient management of MDR-TB management. That's a new guideline that's been created. Actually, I haven't pressed that button, so I'm not even going to tell you what it is. But you could actually you can look at latest guidelines, etc. So whatever somebody in the community has deemed to be the most important latest information, they've put on there. If you wanted to access quick resources, so if you look down to your complete right under topics, let's say for example you said, oh my God, I've got to do a training course on MDR-TB side effects, and I really want to see what everyone else is doing. If you press training curricula, you'll go to a page that will link you to other people's sites. So the idea of this thing is not to recreate the wheel. So if you've got your own websites, they can be linked into this tool. So you'd go there, and let's say, for example, for Partners in Health, that site would then link you to Partners in Health Model Online, and you'd go and you'd be able to see the curricula in Russian and in Spanish and in English. And so you'd be able to choose what you want and use them, because a lot of these things are open source. KNCV would have a link, or you know, we're inviting other people to join. So ultimately, a lot of people developing curricula will have links. I think the most powerful part of this tool is that you can adding the resources is one piece, but having discussions. So you can actually start a discussion. So let's say, for example, you say, I'll tell you a real discussion that's actually on there right now, where a colleague wrote and said, is it okay to use fluoxetine for tuberculosis? It's being sold in our country. We want to buy it. Can we use it? And then it happened to be me in this case, but one of the people responded and said, you know, spifoxacin is a great drug, it's got great anti-TB activity, but it's been pulled from the market in, you know, these places because of these reasons. Now, let's say you come back on a month from now and you're like, oh, we want to use spifoxacin. You can just put spifoxacin into the search engine, and that discussion and the answers will come out. And remember, it's all moderated. So if somebody put, yes, use spifoxacin, this is such a wonderful drug, I love it, that either will, either the moderator will respond and say, actually, the data, you know, suggest against that for these reasons, or certain things, if they're not appropriate, or they're not appropriate parts of the discussion, will be left out. So this is not just, it's not like a general internet page where you're going to get all sorts of garbage. The idea is to actually make sure that this is a really data-based, expert approach. And here's a comprehensive treatment of extensively drug-resistant TB from the New England Journal. So here's a summary of a New England Journal article that was put on the that was added by me, and it's on the website. So for example, if you didn't have time to read this article, you could just go and click on articles and get in, and you could see this thing. Now let's say some of you guys wanted to discuss this and say, wow, isn't that crazy that their cure rates for MDR-TB are 65% and their cure rates for XDR-TB are 60%. This is very strange. Then, you know, you could start a discussion on this, and then hopefully other people would participate. So it's, you know, this is not the answer to health system strengthening on the ground, but I think that this is an important tool that can aid people in sharing information, sharing data, sharing materials, so that we're just not all in our little niches recreating the wheel. We invite people to join the different pages that are there, especially the drug-resistant TB page. You can go to www.ghdonline.org. And if you want to see a live example of this from somebody who actually is one of the designers and is running this, I really invite you to go to the Eli Lilly booth, which is number 19, where you can take a look at this. Thank you.
Thanks, Sylvan. Before I open it up for general questions, just a quick question from my side is, for those of us born before 1975, I mean, I think learning how to use these new tools well is a bigger challenge than it is for our children, like my son who's 15. And I think this is absolutely stellar opportunity for people around the world to use this and to find a niche quickly for their what they perceive as their community. And I guess one of the questions is there one of the things that we find when we have inboxes of our email is that we are still so flooded, how do I manage my email? And one of the things is to remember that I should go into this site and check on it and follow up. So I'm wondering, is there a plan to have sort of alerts or something when we have major new chunks in the, in the site? Because otherwise, many of us, even though we're linked into many of these different networks now, almost too many to try to remember to go to them. So just a query.
That's actually a very important point. So when you log in, you can tell it to send you nothing. You can tell it to send you an update every week. You can tell it to send you an update every month. And then you can just browse that update and see what's been added and what is of interest to you. But Diana, you raised an important point. When I first heard about this, I thought, oh my God, not another thing I have to log into, and this is going to be very stressful. But it turns out that I think the closed communities have been very successful just because they're being used a lot at this point, and now the open communities are being used more. This is really a significant tool. Because when I'm looking for information, if I'm looking for, again, I'm often looking for guidelines or recommendations or something, you're going to about 15 different places. And that clearly takes more time. And as this gets developed and as the linkages happen, this is actually going to be a very powerful tool because you're going to say, I want to know, what are the major decisions from different groups about the use of fluoroquinolones in people who are drug resistant. And you're going to be able to go there and find it. So I think that's going to be the power of this tool, that the information will be in one spot. So it won't just be this. For people really involved in the DRTB community, it's not just going to be another website to log into that's going to be painful. It might actually be very useful. If you're a consultant out in the field and you want to download different tools that you can use for evaluation, et cetera, you'll be able to do this. And that's what we're doing with the Green Light Committee. In the future, our consultants are going to be able to download the instruments that they need to use for evaluation from this site, and this site will be the place where it's actually updated. So I think it's going to be very useful and hopefully not cumbersome.
Questions? I have a question while other people are thinking. Thank you very much for that presentation, Salman, and congratulations on this site, because as a member of the infection control and the drug resistance communities, I'm finding that information incredibly useful, and I'm also very encouraged about how much traffic is going on in terms of communication between people. And I think one of the challenges for all of us in doing these sorts of things is trying to measure impact or success. So I'm just wondering if you all have thought about how you're going to measure some of the work that you've been doing and what the impact is out in the world of this effort.
I knew I should have had my coffee this morning. I don't know the answer to that question. I'm not even going to try and make it up because there's an entire GHD team and they are thinking of metrics that they can use, but I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that. Sorry.
That's okay. All of us have struggled with it. None of us have come up with a good solution.
Yeah, and I just in general, but maybe I won't try and make something up. But in general, these kind of things are difficult to evaluate, just because I would imagine if you make people's lives easier to gather information and you try and put questions and answers to key issues in one spot, how do you evaluate if it's actually translated into making programs better? It's a very, very difficult issue.
We have a question from Ed, and then two questions now. So Ed.
Actually, to amplify what Salman said, is that you can also even have real-time responses and postings. So you can be notified when someone makes a comment, and you may choose not to do that. But it can, so you don't have to go to the site. It comes to you. So it's very aggressive in a way, if you want it to be. And also, we posted entire course content there, and lectures from recent courses, and members, people who've taken courses will continue the dialogue online.
Yeah, you guys, that tool. If you need slides and you need material, again, it's not just and in an ideal world, as this develops, as people join this community, you'll be able to say, what is Ed Nardell saying about infection control? What is the MRC of South Africa saying about infection control? What is the United States Centers for Disease Control saying? And pull all this information together, again, in one spot. That's a very powerful tool.
Hi, I'm Shaheen Mehta. I'm one of the people writing the usual tool. But I come from a very different part of the community, which is actually the people that require treatment, and I'll be talking about infection control. Has it ever occurred to you that perhaps we could include the people that have got MDR, the community as in patients, to be also part of this community, if perhaps not at such a high power level, but certainly at a level where they could understand better?
Shaheen, this is great, because when this first came up, I immediately thought of it more, and I don't know if this is exactly what you have in mind, but I immediately thought of it as an advocacy tool for the advocacy community. But even as general a patient's community, the beauty of this is that we are at the starting point. This is about a year old. And we are inviting people to give ideas for new communities. So if there is a community that you think needs to be developed for which there's a constituency, we're open to that. And I urge you to see Sophie in booth 19, because she is really keen to get these things moving. Are there any other questions? Thanks.
Thank you, Solomon. And he's got a bunch of other sessions.
For the people standing in the back, there are a couple of seats up here in the front. There are three chairs up here if anybody wants to sit down.
So we're going to move on to Reis Mazitov, who's the program manager with Partners in Health in Tomsk, Russia, for work on the Global Fund-related project there. He's been with Partners in Health for 3 years, and I think he's drawing into one of the areas, one of the more challenging areas for all of us as we think about health system strengthening, is that when we talk about the health system as defined by WHO and others, we're not talking about just public health services in the standard Ministry of Health fashion. We also need to be talking across sectors. And Reis is talking about enhancing the engagement and communication linkages from the penitentiary sector. And some of the efforts going on there to improve the linkages and improve the practices. And I think in much of the world, in some parts of the world, there's quite advanced work both on guidelines in working with the prison sector and also in implementation. In other areas of the world, we know that this is still an area where there's often lacking significant resources and people to speak with and political barriers. But I think that's why it's exciting to hear today what we can learn from the Tomsk experience.
Thank you, Anna. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm very honored to be here today to talk a little bit about Tomsk experience. And you may have heard about it, about our program in Tomsk. Where is Tomsk? It's in Russia, and this is the map of Russia. It's basically very big, very huge. It's right in the middle, right here. And this is the region where it's in Siberia, and it's huge in size. It's like a Germany or Poland in size, but with a relatively low population, and it's all dispersed throughout. And basically, it's like swamps, you know, and there are several big cities. And I basically wanted to tell you that there are many other things that are going on in Tomsk. But one of the things, since we started talking about tools, we wanted to point out that the integration between the different sectors is really vital for the success of any program. And we are talking about the continuity of care between sectors. A lot of people think that TB is mainly in prison sector. They may even think that this is the like main source of TB in the community, while in reality, in the population, it's all interlinked, and certain subset of population actually migrates from one sector to another, thereby making the importance of multi-sectoral approach very important. MDR TB is a growing problem, and there was a need to develop an approach or to create a way to contain and treat the infection. If we talk about the MDR TB in the prison sector, what's really happening is that the TB patient who start treatment while in a penitentiary, they may be released before the end of their treatment, which is very long, you know, it's more than 1 year, 1.5 year, and this is actually one of the key points that the patients, when they release, they may need to continue their treatment. In fact, almost 14% of patients need to continue the treatment after the release. But approximately, I mean, I'm talking about Russia here, anywhere, somewhere from like 28% to 60% of those patients who would require to continue their treatment would register at the civilian TB dispensers. And that is a serious problem, because the patients who do not finish treatment, they become source for transmission. And very often, once they release, in a very short time, they may return back to penitentiary. And then they really represent a serious threat to the community there, because it's very close and tight. And this is why we started thinking, and not only we, a lot of people started thinking about the directions for integration. What could be the ways that would enhance the continuity of care? And it was thought that the common programmatic approach to treatment would be one of them, as that the MDR-TB is treated in the same way, in the same high quality, in the prison sector as well as the civilian. Close cooperation between two sectors need to be in place, and coordination of decisions as administrative level also very important. And some way of communication, like a database, or maybe database would be one of the things that would enhance communication, and the constant interaction between TB services also needed to be. All that is actually includes in itself the continuous flow of information between the TB services. The key actors here are actually three ministries: the Ministry of Justice, Internal Affairs, and the Ministry of Health, which makes it quite complicated, as you may understand. And all that activities are actually united under Tomsk Oblast Coordination Mechanism, which is also known as Tomsk CCM, also including Partners in Health and the Tomsk Social Services, Migration Services, and the Welfare Offices. These are the key actors that actually take part in the process. Here, this is the slide that I wanted to show you, the, which is, I think, very interesting, that you see the yellow bar is the population that came into prison from the civil sector. And before the year 2000, you see it was more people would come into prison. But after the year 2000, a lot of people started to be releasing from the penitentiary. Because of the democratization processes in Russia, less people are put in jail, and, you know, for a shorter time, and maybe sometimes, you know, they even just will not be sentenced to prison, maybe like fine or some other ways. So, but that actually shows that exchange between the sectors is a lot, and this is something to keep in mind. Coordination of TB services in Tomsk actually is done through several channels, I could say. It's a coordination council at administration level. like key persons from different sectors would gather together and first of all develop like a certain approach and work together to develop like a way to put thoughts together, you know, that it will be all the same. There is a joint clinical expert commission that takes care about the clinical part of the treatment. A United a Physician Consultation Commission, which is also very important because, as I said, that the treatment should be the same, of the same standard, you know, in different sectors. There are work group meetings of MDRTB program that also, you know, they take place regularly to actually also play. They also play a role to be able, you know, to get things moving. And TB Physician Association meetings. All that is actually makes it. All these actions to be taken, you know, at a regular level, at a constant level. It's not a one-time thing. So it's on a constant level and on a constant basis. And because the patients, you know, they move around, so they had to be. This issue had to be always looked at. That's what I wanted to say. And there is also another thing that we also have in Tomsk is a centralized TB drugs distribution to all TB treatment facilities. Continuity of care between sectors it's also is performed in a certain way. So from the previous discussions with Darcy, we decided to really not talk about like what the problem is, but rather the solutions, like concentrate on how things are done. And this is one of the examples that I could provide for you. There is a pre-release information transfer, like a month before the release. There is a list of TB patients that need to continue their treatment. It's sent to the civilian TB dispensary. So they know that the people are coming for treatment. They are preparing themselves for the new intake. And so the work is done inside the prison and in civilian sector as well. Operative officers in prison would clarify where the TB patient is going to continue treatment, because sometimes, you know, after spending a long time in prison, you know, when they're released, they may go in some different place, and you know, and the whole concept of continuing treatment may not be like on their priority list. You all understand. Post-release exchange of medical documentation is 3 year days after the release. The treatment forms are actually sent to TB dispensaries and to archive. And those treatment lists and the further documentation is actually sent to the place of treatment. So the TB physician from a certain place is prepared and is ready for the patient to come. And he, of course, would know, he or she would know what kind of treatment the patient received before, how much of it left, and it will also enhance the result. And the post-release evaluation by civilian TB doctors. The TB dispensary physician evaluates and continues the treatment plan and tries to accommodate the TB patient within the civilian program. Like, for example, a patient is given a choice of places for treatment. Treatment may be continued at the DOT point, or in polyclinic, or in a hospital. In generally, this is like one of the manifestations of the patient-centered approach. And information is regularly collected and sent into database. And the prison sector is informed about the treatment outcomes on a quarterly basis. On this slide, I wanted to show you that patients released from prison and registered at the TB dispensary, it was not always on the same level. So you can see before the year 2000, most of the people, approximately half of people who were released from prison, they would be registered at the civilian TB dispensary. But as we go up here, and we can see that the gap is getting smaller, and now approximately 70 or 80% of patients who released from prison, they register at the TB dispensary, making it the basis of continued success. And here is another illustration. So from 53%, it grew to 77% patients who continued the treatment. One thing I have mentioned is a centralized TB drug procurement system, which offers additional benefits to the treatment process. First of all, it's the rational TB drugs dispensing. The medicine actually follows the patient. No matter where the patient is, the medicine, the MDR-TB medicine actually follows the patient. It's in the form of the automated database with the centralized information system, which provides easier monitoring, individual control of each patient, and drugs calculation and consumption. It provides verified needs calculation and the stock. It's easier to work with because it's standard procedure for everyone, whether it's penitentiary sector or civilian. And easier and complete reporting because it's all the same, which also actually helped to plan for future. 6 months stock of drug is created. And this in itself actually represents like a unifying link between the different systems, I mean, penitentiary and civilian. Training of personnel is another integral part of the integration, like a joint training of TB doctors from prison and civilian sector. Also serves a purpose that everyone is on the same page, so to speak. And leading specialists, they would train in Central TB Institute in Moscow, and some specialists receive additional training in the United States, like, for example, bacteriologists from both sectors, they receive additional training at Boston. And another important training is psychological training for personnel on how to work with difficult patients in a way to prepare the patient to like cross the border from penitentiary to civilian, which we think is very important because that was one of the barriers to continuing the treatment. Here is another example that I wanted to give. The psychological support for releasing TB patients is done in this way. Like 1 month prior to the release or parole, each TB patient takes part in a special training activity, which includes the working with psychologist starts like 6 months in advance. Social support group, and then a TB doctor, and a group of patients who successfully completed those treatment would make it easier for patient to understand the importance of completing the treatment. And psychological state of TB patient is evaluated. And the receiving TB physician in the civilian sector would know that such and such patient is coming and this is how to work with him, basically. Possible options for treatment are discussed. And patients are told about the social support that will be given to them, will be made available for them. And we are trying to cover both sides of like psychological and social rehabilitation is provided to the TB patient to be able to continue treatment. Social support is actually also given to the TB patients in Tomsk. Food, sex are given as an incentive, and then there is an assistance in recovery of lost documents, lodging, employment, and sometimes covering transportation. Shelters or welfare is also provided for them. And basically, there was also one thing that we also offer, that if a patient comes for registration, he or she would receive like a gift. And that it enhanced our registration rates. This is just one of the results that I wanted to show you, that this is a treatment outcomes of DOTS Plus in prison sector from year 2000-2004. 80% of a patient cured, and 3% of death, but which is very low, of course, you understand. 3.5 is failure, and default is like 12%. And this is a TB mortality, and you can see that the prison system, like the red is the prison system, and the blue is this is the red is Tomsk, and the blue is the prison system in Russia. So you can see that the prison system in Tomsk had very high mortality, but now it's much lower than the average in Russia. And here is the TB incidence in Tomsk prison system. And in this slide, you can see red is prison, which is like penitentiary sector. Jail is, you can say that this is a civilian sector, because there the jail is like, it's like the people when they put, you know what jail is, right? So before they enter the penitentiary sector, they put in jail. I just want to make sure, because this actually represents the exchange that I talked about. And you can see that here, in year 2004, there was actually a crossover between the sectors. So the TB incidence in prison became lower, in a way, than in civilian sector. And if we talk about the results, I could say that continuity of care brought us to common standards of care and diagnostics in both sectors. Shared statistical database and similar reporting. Another advantage is the constant flow and the regular exchange of information, as I said before. And we had improved psychological and social support, centralized TB drugs fund, and joint training of medical personnel. These things enable prison and civilian sector to work in sync, which also led to the better results of integrated MDR-TB program in Tomsk Oblast. It has improved epidemiological TB situation. It has increased effectiveness of treatment, decreasing TB mortality. The common MDR-TB system in both sectors has been developed. And the Tomsk prison seems to be the main source of TB infection in Tomsk Oblast. I want to thank all these people who worked very hard to develop this system. It took us quite some time until we were able to actually tune up the system to be able to get very good results. And the partnership between, you know, different representatives from different sectors actually results in enhancing the continuity of care. Also, I just wanted to say one more thing, is that if we talk about the examples of how things are done, this may show that certain things, they are possible, they are doable. This is one just want to say, that a lot of people, when they think, like, if that's a large-scale endeavor, would require a lot of effort, but will it yield result? Will it actually work? And this is one of the proof that it can be done. It works in Tomsk. And we are very happy that we were able to build that. And I guess if you have questions or maybe suggestions or, you know, some comments, I'd be happy to take that. Are we in time? On time? No? Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the outstanding presentation. I think you've shown not just that it can work, but how. And I think many times we just seeing the sheer step-by-step how you do it is absolutely essential, and also giving us some pretty important indicators of impact. And in the discussion session, it might be interesting to hear in a minute a little bit more about this linkage between DOTS and DOTS Plus in the prison sector now. I mean, you were presenting both. This is what you do for DOTS patients as well as MDR patients.
That's right. It'd
be good to clarify. We are pleased, however, before we open up for general questions, we're pleased that General Konnets from the Russian Federation is here with us, and it would be of great value to hear a couple of added comments if you'd like to comment for us on perspectives from the Russian Federation on this work and other activities in Russia.
Yes, we are very fortunate to have with us the head of the TB penitentiary medical system, Dr. Konnets, and could ask him to make a comment.
If you'd like to come up here.
Добрый день, уважаемые коллеги. Будет перевод?
Good morning, dear colleagues.
Почему я считаю, что пенитенциарная составляющая в эпидемической ситуации Российской Федерации, в общем-то, играет одну из главных ролей?
Why I think that the penitentiary system is like one of the key areas for the TB treatment?
Потому что ситуация начала 90-х годов Российской Федерации.
Situation in early 90s in the Russian Federation.
Складывалась таким образом, что пенитенциарная система Российской Федерации в 99-м году содержалась четверть всех больных активной формы туберкулеза Российской Федерации.
In 1999, actually, have contained almost a quarter of all MDR TB patients in the Russian Federation.
В тюрьме было около 100 тысяч больных активной формы туберкулеза.
Approximately 100,000 of TB patients kept in the...
Всего в Российской Федерации тогда состояло на учете почти полмиллиона человек больных активной формы туберкулеза.
There was almost 500,000 of MDR patients.
И, естественно, при той эпидситуации все обязательные противоэпидемические мероприятия в тюремной системе, конечно же, играли колоссальную роль в ситуации в России.
So all these epidemiologic activities that taking place in the penitentiary system would play an important role in general in Russian Federation.
И абсолютно относительные показания заболеваемости и смертности могли констатировать фактически эпидемию.
So, and main indicators like mortality and incidence in TB would show the status of the epidemic.
Но если немножко историю, то во времена Советского Союза в 1989 году всего в тюрьме на полтора миллиона заключенных было 39 тысяч больных активных.
A little bit of history. In the Soviet time before 1989,
Тюрьме было 39 тысяч больных активных форм туберкулеза в 89 году.
39,000 of MDR TB patient at that time was in prison.
Надо сказать, что в СССР была очень четкая медицинская и социальная противоэпидемические мероприятия, очень сильный социальный пакет, который позволял освежить больного, на всех его периодах заболевания и реабилитации.
Yes, in the Soviet time, the system of the social care and the medical treatment was on a very high level that allowed to actually control the TB infection.
И после распада Советского Союза.
After the collapse of the Soviet Union.
И резко падение жизненного уровня населения.
And the rates of impoverishment grew, and which led to.
Ну и других всем известных социально-экономических причин мы столкнулись, если брать точку отсчета 1999 год, как я уже говорил, с фактически с эпидемией туберкулеза.
Which led to like. Practically anti-B epidemics in 1989.
Поэтому Томский проект, который сейчас с успехом, в общем-то,
That's why the Tomsk project, which is
завершился на данном этапе
for a successful implementation.
Об этом говорят впечатляющие цифры и заболеваемости и смертности.
The indicators represent a proof for that.
Можно рассматривать как оптимальный вариант на данном этапе. Российской Федерации.
Could be seen as an optimal model for implementation in the whole of Russian Federation.
То есть оптимальный вариант как проведения медицинских, как проведения и социальных мероприятий.
Optimal model for like medical activities as well as social.
Касающихся больных туберкулеза.
For the MDR, for the TB patients.
Здесь, собственно. Прослеживается самое удачное сочетание федеральных властей, региональных властей, направленных на общую борьбу с этим заболеванием.
So this is like a representation of integration the federal and the region and the regional authorities to work on the same issue.
В 2000 году мы консолидировали свои силы совместно с Министерством здравоохранения, Всемирной организацией здравоохранения, создали рабочую группу по этой проблеме. В том числе с участием Всемирной организации здравоохранения, как я говорил, выработали стратегический план мероприятий обязательно для Российской Федерации.
In year 2000, a work group was created containing of the Ministry of Justice, Ministry of Health, and also with taking part WHO, and a certain strategy has been developed.
В это же время был издан приказ номер 109 Минздрава.
At the same time, the executive order 109 has been released.
Которые практически унифицированы все эти мероприятия.
That actually regulates all these unified activities.
Поэтому три источника финансирования, которые считаются у нас главными и направлены были на эти цели, это федеральные, региональные бюджеты. И бюджеты неправительственных организаций, и впоследствии Глобальный фонд и Всемирный банк.
The sources of financing are several, which is the federal, regional, and also international aid.
Консолидация этих источников позволит более-менее адекватно подойти к проблеме.
Consolidation of all these financing sources allowed us to adequately come to solving this problem.
Параллельно проводилось обязательная учеба для медицинского персонала.
Parallelly, the training for the medical personnel has been.
И как обязательная составляющая этой программы, конечно же, усилилась социальная часть этих мероприятий.
As part of that training, the social support was underlined.
Было время, когда в том же Томске из 10 человек, выходящих на свободу, только двое продолжали лечение.
There were times, even in Tomsk, when only two people from 10 would continue the treatment after the release.
Ну, сейчас на презентации вы видели, что это достаточно
60%.
Вот комплекс этих мероприятий позволил нам вот к сегодняшнему году уменьшить заболеваемость и смертность практически в три раза.
So the complex of all these actions that had that I have talked about allowed us to decrease incidence and the mortality almost three times.
Сегодня мы можем говорить о определенной стабилизации ситуации.
So we probably can talk about the stabilization of the situation.
Однако новые угрозы не заставили себя ждать.
Of course, the new threats are still
резистентные формы туберкулеза, которые 5-6 лет тому назад составляли где-то 4-5-6%.
Like
сегодняшнему дню в уголовной исправительной системе достигает
16-18%.
А если еще учесть то, что где-то 8% из них ВИЧ-инфицированные больные,
Also taking into consideration that some of them are also patients with HIV infection,
то проект наш становится очень затратным.
So the our project is actually becoming very costly.
И естественно требует дополнительного финансирования.
And it also requires additional financing.
Здесь нам помогают федеральные целевые программы.
And here we actually get help from the federal. From the special federal programs,
направленные на борьбу с ВИЧ, СПИДом и туберкулезом,
to combat the TB and HIV.
Но мы уже сегодня вынуждены ставить вопрос перед правительством о дополнительном финансировании, о дополнительных средствах этих федеральных целевых программ.
Today we already are actually raising the question for before the federal authorities.
И они, я так думаю, будут выделены, потому что в нашей стратегической программе мы предусматриваем как минимально это создание резерва полугодового препарата для лечения простых и резистентных форм туберкулеза.
Yes, and we hope that it will all work out because we have several like plans in mind, like having a stock, like a 6-month stock for the drugs. Are we on time, or shall we continue?
Я хотел отметить, пользуясь случаем, еще наши клинические федеральные центры. Это институты Российской Федерации. Возглавляемый профессором Перельманом, Ерохиным Красновым, профессор. Ерохин здесь присутствует.
Одну секундочку, я не успел перевести. I'm sorry, I'm not a professional translator, so yes, sometimes it takes time for me to translate. So basically, I wanted to thank our federal institutions, and one of them, which is directed by the Dr. Perelman, another important people are actually present on this conference, the Professor Ерохин.
Краснов. Ну и многие другие. Я хочу этим подчеркнуть то, что ведущие клинические институты, они постоянно курируют эту проблему и с научной точки зрения, и с методической, и с экспертной.
Yeah, I just want to underline that all these important institutions, they work together and they make sure that it's on that the attention is directed to all these issues. Well, thank you very much, and I will wish you good health and happiness.
I think we need to acknowledge also that I think Russia is a pathfinder at the ministerial level and institutional level to have this collaboration. When we had the meeting planned in China, the ministerial meeting on MDR response, we meet many more countries and we'll be inviting ministries of justice to that meeting. So we hope to hear more at that major meeting next spring about the collaboration at the highest level in Russia. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
So, shall we take a few questions for either speaker right now? Delia?
Could you go to the microphone, please?
My questions would be, basically, what I wanted to know whether you have some data to show which one of the social intervention that you have implemented is the one that is helping you the most, whether you have some data that can show if there's any comparison between people that do not are integrated in this kind of approach and those that actually do in terms of impact. And if there is any data about the any kind of rate of re-imprisonment, I mean the recurrence of imprisonment in people that adhere to this program, because these things have the potential to have an impact beyond to be controlled.
Yes, yes, you are absolutely right. The examples that I have shown in this presentation is actually are the things that that are working, which is we have proof for, we could say. There are other activities are going on, but we probably will not be able to really put the finger on some things that, okay, this is actually makes a better result than others. As I said in the beginning, there are many other activities are going on in Tomsk, and to your second question, that the comparison between those who receive the help or not, that I can say that in Tomsk, everybody receives help. So probably this is one of the things that we should work on, and this is a question for myself, that we could compare between different regions who doesn't have such good programs. They probably have good programs, but you know, we have to compare. And to your third question, yes, this is another thing to look at, that perhaps we can point out certain things that actually the help goes beyond a certain level and in terms of re-imprisonment. Yeah, I know if that answers your question, but all right, thank you.
Okay, one more question.
I was just wondering where the financing for the social support that you provide on the lease comes from.
All right, that's a great question, though. As I said, that this is like a body. It's like an instrument, is you know, where the different key actors play, so everybody makes their input. You know, like I have mentioned that the Tomsk Social Services take part in all these activities, and certain things are covered by them, and that's a federal financing. And we especially pay a lot of attention to that, because that represents sustainability of our activities. Of course, major part of financing right now is done through the Global Fund grant, which is in the fourth year now in Tomsk. But we are trying, and that's, I think, very common to all of the projects of the Partners in Health throughout the world, to actually think about these things and try to incorporate all the sources into one so it can function independently for a long time. Okay.
Okay, I think we need to move on. Maybe we can save the rest of the questions until the end and our discussion with the entire panel. Thank you so much, Rice.
Thank you for your attention.
And thank you so much for joining us for this panel. Okay, now we're going to switch gears a little bit, and we're going to talk not about kind of the macro level, what we can do on a global level to coordinate and strengthen health systems, or looking at communication between parts of the system, but we're going to talk very specifically about the effects of health systems and weaknesses in health systems on the people who have to function in them, so the healthcare workers. So I would like to welcome our next speaker, Karen Sheen, from a very different region of the world, South Africa. Karen has been one of the pioneers, I would say, in MDR TB control. She worked for 15 years in the Western Cape in South Africa as the MDR-TB co-coordinator for services, and she now works as the scientific officer at the Lung Infection and Immunity Unit, Department of Medicine in the University of Cape Town. So Karen, welcome.
Right, hi, good morning everyone. Okay, so we're gonna be looking at essentially drug-resistant TB in South Africa, the challenges faced by healthcare workers. A citation by Parker and Getz says, MDR and XDR TB are monsters of our own creation. Just a little bit of the history of XDR-TB in South Africa. It started in September 2006, as I think most of us know, when it was announced there was a new deadly strain of XDR-TB, and that was in KwaZulu-Natal. Of 221 cases diagnosed with MDR-TB, 53 were identified as XDR, and this included 6 healthcare workers, of which I think it was 2 that died. TB, the other things about that outbreak was that 100% of the patients were HIV positive, and the, I think the median time was 16 days to death in that outbreak. Now, XDR-TB in the Western Cape is where I work, as Marcy said. We have identified between November 06, when the word XDR-TB, the definition, came to be, and April 97, in April this year, 97 XDR-TB patients have been identified, including 2 children. We have got historical cases. We've had a look at deaths, historical deaths, and we found 23 historical cases, going back as far as the mid-1990s. We're busy having a look at that cohort as well at the moment. Okay, so of the 95 adults, 49 were female, 46 male, age range 20 to 60, with a median of 33, and 94 patients were tested for HIV, and 38%, which, as we can see, is vastly different to what was found in KwaZulu-Natal. Okay, what happens to these patients? At the moment, 40 of these 95 patients are being treated as inpatients at the TB facility in Cape Town. There's one XDR facility for the whole province in which I'm working. There are 5 TB facilities, but one specifically for XDR. The length of stay is between 1 and 693 days, which was 23 months, and the median is 248 days, or 8 months. 10 of these XDR-TB patients have converted and been discharged. Conversion was between 2 months and 12 months, with a mean of 5 months. 3 are being treated in isolation within prisons. 6 have absconded, and 40% of the patients have died. So what are the challenges facing healthcare workers? Hospitalisation of all patients diagnosed with XDR-TB until conversion, and this is our national policy at present. But sort of a gap in that policy is what happens to these patients that are in, as we've seen in the previous slide, that are in hospital for 23 months and longer. You know, what is going to happen to them? And not much has gone into what, you know, what's going to be the long-term solution for these chronic patients. The second thing challenging healthcare workers is the brain drain from South Africa. The burden of care, TB and HIV infections amongst healthcare workers, infection control, and poor remuneration and work environment. Okay, so here we have it, the hospitalisation of patients diagnosed with XDR-TB until conversion. It's a huge dilemma, you know, and there's been a lot of work being done presently in South Africa, and I know in other parts of the world, on the outpatient treatment of XDR-TB. This in itself has its own problems, especially as the regimen we're using to treat MDRs is capromycin and PASS-based, and it's the challenges of treating patients with these 2 drugs, and it's their side effect profile as community patients. And okay, so the challenges to the healthcare workers trying to treat these patients is they face the prospect of a long hospital stay. The treatment can often have unpleasant side effects, as I already alluded to. Patients face at least 24 months of treatment, the possibility of premature death, driving the epidemic underground. And this is there's some thoughts that perhaps the fact that these patients are going to be involuntary placed into hospital for undisclosed number of months could prevent patients from coming forward to be treated. And of course, reinfection in hospital, which is a big thing. We don't quite know the extent that it happens. We know it happens, and we are obviously having a look at that at the moment. We looked at strain typing of patients when they were admitted, and we're now looking some way down the line to see if there is cross transmission. Okay. Now, abscondment is also a huge problem to the healthcare workers of these patients. As you saw, there were six patients that have absconded. Now, some of those come in and out of the hospital. There's one particular fellow who comes in when he's hungry, and he knows it's where he can get some food. Very difficult to control this, because you can't lock them into a room, or. So, anyway, but this is looking at abscondments in 2005 between two TB facilities. Facility one, the abscondment rate was 15%, and in facility B it was 11%. We are looking at present, and I don't have any figures at the moment, but we're looking at the interventions that have been put in place to try and bring this abscondment and try and keep these patients in hospital and the problems associated with that. We are monitoring that at the moment, and it would be very nice to see, but unfortunately we don't have anything at the moment. Some of the interventions that have been put in place in these healthcare facilities are things like education, counselling, and emotional support. Proper early counselling to ensure good adherence to the program, to the treatment, so that we can hopefully get some successful outcomes. Further support is required, obviously, to identify social and emotional problems early. And these are the kind of patients, the XDR, the MDR patients, that are the ones that very often have these kind of problems. And I thought it was a good idea in the prisons where they have a psychological profile done before they're discharged. I think that could possibly be very good in our situation as well. Okay, now I'm trying to make the patients stay as comfortable as possible. And what has been put into place by the health systems, by the healthcare workers, are things like counselling, entertainment, these games, this sport, this snooker. And it's quite strange to see these patients with their masks on playing snooker against each other. We have support groups. We're looking at behaviour modification modules to change the behaviour and to stop some of the things they do, like the smoking and the drugs and things. We do skills training. We train them in various skills, lead work, leather work, gardening. But it would be very nice to see those skills have been given can be used outside the hospital. I mean, that hasn't been okay. And the creature comforts, they're allowed their own duvets. They can bring their TVs into the hospital. They get newspapers, and they get, various. They get more access to food and drink and during the day and things like that. We've also looked at the possibility of implementing step-down facilities the patients, ones that are going to be there long-term for an indefinite amount of time, are put in houses, which would have a house mother or somebody to just, tidy up and maybe cook for them or whatever. But they would essentially live in a house, in a more open environment, where they would have control, make their own beds and live more normally. And that's busy being looked at the moment. Now, the brain drain, the most critical issue facing healthcare systems is the shortage of people who make them work. South Africa produces some 2,500 nurses a year, and in 2006, almost 5,000 of those were working overseas. Centre for Global Development in 2006 said that there was at least over 12,000 South African healthcare workers practicing abroad. The nurse patient ratio in South Africa declined from 120 per 100,000 in 2000 to 109. For 100,000 in 2005. And if we compare that to America, there's almost 1,000 registered nurses for every 100,000 Americans. Put that in perspective. Nurses in South Africa are expected to accept unreasonable workloads, work outside their scope of practice, and are increasingly being put at risk of professional negligence due to shortage of nurses. And that's a quote. I didn't say that. HIV infection. We know that South Africa counts for 30% of all people living with HIV globally in the world, and has the highest number of people living with HIV. It's estimated that about 600 people die every day. The figures from 2003 estimated that almost 16% of nurses were HIV positive. And that was what, 5 years ago, so I'm sure it's substantially more now. And the HIV/AIDS crisis in developing countries is rapidly depleting the current workforces and increasing the overall workload. So some of the other challenges facing healthcare workers that are infected with TB or HIV through their work or just through the community. Healthcare workers may be afraid of being diagnosed with TB and HIV, the detection and marginalization by colleagues, which could lead to delay in diagnosis, treatment, which can in turn lead to nosocomial transmission, fear of losing one's job and one's own possible fate, and the risk for occupationally acquired infection is an unavoidable part of daily patient care that must be recognised. Okay, so what is healthcare worker safety in the face of MDR-TB? There is a duty and obligation of employer to create a safe workplace. And I think a lot of nurses in developing countries, they don't have a voice. And they don't educate themselves, they don't make known to themselves what they are entitled to. Factors that contribute to transmission of TB, as we know, the delayed diagnosis, the delayed initiation of treatment, this doesn't help the plight of some of the healthcare workers. Okay, let's look at TB in healthcare workers quickly. We don't actually notify TB in healthcare workers, but we did some facility reporting. I'm afraid this is quite old, it's from 1999 to 2002. I don't know of anything more recent, where we looked at TB in healthcare workers. And as we would expect, the laboratory was the highest, followed by tertiary hospitals, TB facilities, clinics. The tertiary hospitals at 1.8%. Secondary hospitals and then pediatric and community health clinics or community health centres right down the bottom. MDR-TB and healthcare workers. We find about 8,000 healthcare workers with MDR-TB. We're finding about 6,000 and 8,000 cases of MDR-TB nationally. We've identified 32 healthcare workers with MDR-TB, and that's between September 1989 and November 2005. 28 were HIV tested, 24 negative. 26 of these healthcare workers had been treated for TB before, and this is an important thing that should have been looked at the time, which actually never was. And it was worked out that the number of healthcare workers at the time was about 11 per 100,000. Now, interesting to see was that most of these came from academic hospitals. 56% of these healthcare workers were employed at academic hospitals. And this, of course, is the undiagnosed case, we would assume, you know, and your outpatients, your casualty areas, your places where healthcare workers. And then followed by secondary TB facilities comes in at third. Categories of healthcare worker, once again we see that the highest number is amongst our assistant nurses, and they generally, followed by your general assistants, and they generally have the most in-your-face contact with patients. So this is also very interesting to see. Now looking at XDR-TB and healthcare workers, we've found four healthcare workers that have had or got XDR-TB. Two were historical, they were diagnosed prior to 2006, and two have been just diagnosed since then. They're all HIV negative. One was a student nurse in an academic hospital, one was a medical officer at a secondary hospital, and there were two nurses, one from a district hospital and one from a TB facility. Now, just looking at some of the infection control issues, okay, in our setting, as you can see, this is the doctor holding an MXDR-TB clinic. There's no masks, there's no respirators being worn. It's a very small room. There's no, there's a little bit of sunlight, some germicidal sunlight coming in, but otherwise there's no airflow, there's not much at all. And this is for our patients waiting to be seen at the semi-rural clinic. And once again, I mean, these patients are waiting to be seen at the MDR clinic, and yet in between them, there are babies waiting to be seen as well. And this is, and here we have a crowded waiting room with the patients spilling into the corridor, and some of these patients are waiting to be seen by the MXDR TV. So what is the way ahead? The education of healthcare workers, the informed decisions on employment options, the knowledge that if they are immunocompromised for whatever reason, that they do not have to work with M or XDR TB patients, they have got the right to be asked to move somewhere else. Notification of healthcare workers with TB, addressing the various legal and ethical issues that comes out of all of these things, as well as HIV testing, the confidentiality, easy access, programs to encourage testing, reducing the stigma around VCT, and employment options, which I've mentioned. Diagnosing TB in healthcare workers, we need to start looking at rapid diagnostics for testing healthcare workers. We are busy with a prospective study with looking at 1,500 healthcare workers in the Western Cape and looking at various rapid diagnostics. We need urgent infection control, and I'm sure Professor Mehta is going to cover all of this. But the simple things, the triaging, the airflow, the getting the patients to put their hands over their mouth, and I say it's not even done in the XDR wards. Money, expertise have been set aside for these kind of interventions, but little has been used. And there's no coordinated IC control policy. It seems to be little pockets of people kind of doing their own thing. So we can see that the prevalence of XDR is going up, and there is a lot of work that needs to be done, and we certainly need to look at protecting our healthcare workers as well from getting these diseases. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I think this presentation has given us a real view from the clinical perspective, from the worker perspective, and from the environmental perspective, infection control overall. Just in the interest of time, as our other speakers, I'm going to suggest that Professor Shaheen Mehtar comes up now, and then we have both speakers accept questions, as we have two speakers on the South African situation. Professor Shaheen Mehtar was trained in medical microbiology and infectious diseases. She has moved to South Africa and long ago, and now is head of the unit for infection prevention and control at Tygerberg Academic Hospital and Stellenbosch University. She has been critical for the establishment of infection prevention and control in the region and globally. And as we know, this is a key theme for the conference here and a key element for health system strengthening, given that infection control is obviously not exclusively against TB mycobacteria, but a common concern in hospital and all congregate settings. So we're very glad to welcome her here.
Thank you very much. I'd love to say something, but I can't because my slides are stuck. What I would like to, however, say is that, while I'm waiting to unstick my slides, is that working in a developed country and then working now for the last 10 or 15 years in a country with less resources, you really go through a tremendous mindset change. And the major change is that there is an expected infrastructure that works in developed countries that does not exist in other countries. And one of the major issues around infection control seems to be that while all of us understand that infection control is a process and it's made up of lots and lots of procedures, when you start looking at infection control for tuberculosis or for HIV or for whatever else, they go into silos, which means they don't talk to each other. And if they don't talk to each other, you can never have a good, coherent program that will run across the board, which will allow the protection of healthcare workers, community workers, and indeed anybody else who's wandering past your corridors at the time. Shall I just get my stick and stick it in here and talk?
I don't think it operates. I'm not sure if it operates.
Oh, it doesn't do that. Okay. It still doesn't do that.
Let's take just 1 second then to ask any clarifying questions.
That would help. Sure.
Do we have any questions on the previous presentation? I'll take one here.
Yes. I'd like to know, in South Africa, you mentioned that you kept the patient for such a long time in the hospital. My question is, who supports financially for such activity with all the games? Also, you mentioned about this special housing for those patients?
Was everybody able to hear that? The question was the financing source for support structures for patients during their long term of care.
All TB treatment, anything to do with TB is covered by the government. Yeah. So, you know, all TB treatment is free, anything that happens within the hospitals. And there has been a lot of money being spent.
Yeah, here's the microphone, please. Thank you.
There's a lot of money being put forward for the care of XDRs and to provide extra entertainment, other kind of facilities, and it's all been covered by Department of Health. We've put in a lot of money just specifically for XDR.
Is this federal money or provincial money? Or
no, it's national, but in, you know, it's divided up amongst the provinces, and of course they put in what, you know, what the limits are of that particular province. We have 9 provinces in South Africa.
We have, let's pass the, there's one here and then Ed.
Can you use the microphone to ask a question, please? Thank
I'm
you.
A little bit
we
stuck
have a webcast.
Here.
I know, sorry.
It's a very short question.
I'll repeat it. Okay.
Is there admittance in the hospital voluntarily?
No. So the question was, is the admittance in the hospital voluntarily based?
Well, we try, you know, most of the patients do come in voluntary. We have had some who don't. We've actually made a court case. We took this to the Constitutional Court to get a ruling. And, you know, and the thing is, and I didn't really want to go into this too much, but, you know, it's the individual right versus the public right. You know, and this is a very serious a disease. I mean, we've seen out of nearly 100 patients that less than 10% have converted. We don't have any other outcome data yet. So, you know, the ruling was in the favour that these patients could be involuntary. But now, we're getting to the point now, which was very interesting and not really looked at, you know, it's kind of a dealing with the crisis as, a, you know, just with crisis management, you know, just put the fires out as they occur. Now we're getting to the point where we've had patients in for 23 months, some of them are becoming pre-terminal, they want to go home, they want to die at home. Well, some of them are still quite well, but they've got young children at home, they have other social problems. And what we find there is that we've now got a review committee, and we've all been appointed, whoever's on that board is appointed by the provincial minister of health, so that we make these decisions, or we make recommendations, and they go up to the level of the minister of health, and he will ratify the recommendations. And we're looking now at sending patients home with, you know, with in control situations and with infection control and how, you know, whether we need to build a room on or what we need to do. And that's the kind of thing we're looking at now.
Somebody's doing something like that.
I just want to comment on this point. We actually faced a similar problem in Massachusetts in the early 80s and with not MDR, XDR, but just drug-resistant TB in the homeless. And we had a system in place of legal constraint and ultimately developed a very rational way and humane way to of compulsory treatment with all of the social supports you mentioned, and was a key factor, we think, and New York adopted it during the 85 to 92 problem as well with that MDR-TB, where you could break that cycle, because these absconders leaving the hospital is just not a way to go.
No, it's a huge thing.
I'm online, as they say.
Excellent. All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your questions. And
yes, and thank you for everybody entertaining each other while we're trying to get sorted. Okay. We know this, but I just want to actually put it into patient perspective, because I work in a hospital. It's a 1,300-bedded hospital, and for my sins, I've been involved with infection control across the province and nationally and certain other countries as well. And I think when we're sitting at a very large, high, global, really high-powered people like we have in this room, we seem to forget that there's a bod at the end of this receiving. And this person, who is part of a population that is about 1,000 per 100,000 population in South Africa, and this person is also one of a population that might have HIV and is 27%. The co-infection that we know is about 60, and in some countries that I've visited in Africa, thank you, Darcy, for some of the countries we've visited in Africa, we're looking at 80% co-infection. So if you're going to go into an infection control program, it'll be very remiss of you to jump in with just covering your face and mouth, because you are going to have to be looking at the transmission of blood-borne viruses as well. And the whole point about this, the process of infection control, is it cannot just be targeted. It is a risk assessment system. It's a system that works. And had you had it in place in the first place, you wouldn't have had the number of people that Karen has talked about for your healthcare workers and others getting the TB. So I think it's a really important aspect of when you set up your health systems to understand that you're not just looking at one little bit. Without going into loads of factors that influence the people that we talk about, we're looking at really just here, specifically, I'd like to talk about the factors linked to clinics. And because we work in silos, there isn't very much coordination. I think we heard some impression of that from Karen today, because she was saying, look, we're working in the hospital, then the patients go out, then they come back, and you know, everybody's bouncing between various areas, and there's a discontinuity of care. And to my mind, as an infection control practitioner, this is a really important part, and it, as a clinician, it becomes doubly important. There's a task orientation problem, that I'm doing this and no more. Obviously, there's very little patient education, and this seems to be the major problem we're having in South Africa. Everybody disregards the people that are at the receiving end of fistful of pills every day for the rest of their lives sometimes, or an injection, or being jabbed. And a very, to me, an essential aspect of containing disease in any of these bits has got to be the inclusion of the community. If your community is not on your side, you can do what you like. You'd never, ever work. And we've got some experience with that now, and it's worked an absolute treat. In the clinics, apart from everybody crowding around, as you see here, because they do not have an appointment system, it's also got very rigid opening hours. And not only are we short of staff, but we also have an enormous amount of handwritten admin paperwork to do, such as filling out TB registers and filling out this and filling out that. So on Friday, there are no clinical practice areas. All the nurses are sitting down filling out forms. And one has got to re-examine this as far as the availability of care over a period of time to the number of people that you see here. So therefore, there are long waiting times. Obviously, there's overcrowding. As we can see, there's somebody sitting there with a stick, but their babies, their children. And this is quite clear. And of course, the ventilation, which is a terribly important thing. But you must imagine that this was never designed for this sort of workload. It was only ever designed for people to come in, say, hi, how are you? Would you like some porridge? Here you go. Here are your pills, and we'll see you the day after tomorrow. It was never designed to have such an onslaught and such a heavy disease burden as one has. Mercifully, the WHO has suggested that we have got not a very high incidence of MDR cases, and this is their data between 1994 and 2007, let's say compared to some of the other countries around. But that could very well change. If we don't look at the way we're dealing with things, I think that could very well change. However, as we're sitting at the moment, it's quite evident that while HIV is driving the TB epidemic in general, mercifully, it is not really affecting the MDR issue. So that's not as though you've got more MDR in HIV-positive people. You've got HIV, you get TB. Whether you get an MDR strain or you get a sensitive strain is really your luck, unless you get landed in a terrible nosocomial thing. And that, I think, is a very consoling active finding, because for us to know that it's not the TB that we have to concentrate on, the HIV part of it, we just concentrate on the TB with the HIV, we should get some mileage out of it in the long run. I just want to present some data from the Tigerberg Hospital, which was 6 months surveillance. It was done as part of an NPH study, one of my students. And it was just looking at TB. I don't think this was the first time we did it, but I think this certainly was the first time we did it properly. So it made a big difference to the outcome. And we were looking at, during that time, in this 1,300-bedded hospital, we admitted over 33,000 people. That's a lot of people wandering in and out, if I compare that to my hospital in England, where I worked for a very long time. Of the total population, we had 1.2 with MD, with the TB confirmed. 17% or so were in the outpatient, but 83% of them were in the inpatient. Now, that's no surprise, because it's an inpatient tertiary referral academic hospital. So everybody who's going to be terribly ill is going to land up in hospital. All of those that we could test, 50% were positive. And this was a very different reflection to what we were seeing outside, where in fact, as you heard from Karen, it's a much lower reflection. So not only are you getting very sick people with TB coming in, but you're getting them in with TB and HIV coming in, and that actually starts putting a lot of pressure on the infection control programs in that hospital. We managed to get microbiology results on 394, and as you can see here, of the smear positive, about 28, culture positive. But we did pick up more than the community, because at the time, Karen Beyer had reported 2.9 and 3%. Others had reported 5% MDR in the Western Cape. We found it was almost 10%. So there was a concentrated group coming into hospital, causing a little bit of problems. Now, this is the bit that becomes absolutely crucial to infection control, and I think we need to just look at this. From the time that somebody comes into hospital, and by the time you diagnose them, what we actually found was not everybody that was had TB was actually on the medical ward. We found them on the neonatal units, we found them on the mother and care child, we found them in maternity, we found them in surgery, we found them everywhere. So basically, if you're concentrating all your infection control efforts in one area, you miss a lot. But this is the bit that actually makes a big difference. And that is that if you're not expected to have TB and you come into hospital to have your hernia removed or, you know, get a leg amputated or whatever, and you're coughing all over the place, it takes a while for people to click that there might be a case of tuberculosis because you're trained in a completely different way to look at disease. However, what it does do, of course, is that by the time you land up thinking about it, getting it going and so on, you have now got yourself on the outside of 42 days of a potentially infectious source lying in the middle of a ward. If he's had a motor car accident or a motorbike accident, he's going to be stranded up there for at least 6 to 7 months. Okay. And the length of stay for the TB cases that we had, if they had no sensitivity done, they stayed in for 10 days. And if they were not an MDR, then they had 17 days. If they were an MDR, they were certainly there for 36 days. Now, to my mind, as both a clinician and an infection control practitioner, the best way of good infection control is get them out of the hospital. Get them out, because that's my job, is to get rid of them, go into the community, and just get them away. So you have to start looking at structures that will take away people from the hospital as soon as possible, where there's a very large other vulnerable group of people that you have to save them from. The mortalities that we found with the crude mortality for Tigerberg was 3, and this, of course, is no surprise that the mortality associated with tuberculosis here was about 3 times higher, which is about 9. I'm going to go through this very, very quickly, not because, I mean, if there's anybody in this room who hasn't read this paper, then I'd like strongly suggest that they do. But I think there are 2 or 3 things that I need from here to talk about certain other aspects. And the first one of all was that there was, because of the similarity of genotype, it was quite clear that there was nosocomial transmission going on. And that was the first indication that, in fact, there was something quite sinister happening for all of these. And I think you've heard most of the other stories anyway from Karen. But what was interesting, and I'd like to have discussion about this, was this is the first document that was written on looking at the modeling, and Basu took the data from what I've just shown you and looked at some of the interventions to avert XDR-TB. The community-based treatment, he said, deferred up to about 10%, and I'm sure Ed is going to talk about this later. Rapid drug susceptibility testing is useful, but what he did, of course, find in there, or they did present it in the Lancet, was that if you could improve the ventilation in any way, that would make a profound outcome difference. You could avert a third of your disease. Now, if we can think back to the photograph that I showed of the outpatient department, it's really not a very good sign if you look at what the data suggests. Looking at masks, it didn't do much for protecting cases, but it certainly did a lot to protect the staff, and of course if we started antiretrovirals. And here again, we differ from the United States. The United States, they wait and they treat with antiretrovirals after TB treatment. In South Africa, we don't. We actually start with antiretrovirals because we have to. But this was really quite interesting as well. Further to say that if we reduce the length of stay, so I'm a firm believer in throwing people out of the hospital as soon as possible, and if you can reinforce your protective clothing, a third again can be averted. Add ventilation to that, you're looking at 37%. And of course then you go on to sensitivity. So we could possibly, by just intervening appropriately and looking at the ARV, which is the HIV side of it, and the TB side of it together, make a profound difference, I'd imagine, to approximately 50% of the sort of cases that might occur and protect the healthcare workers. I'm going to raise something which I hope doesn't cause too much controversy, but it is a very, very important thing. And that is that every time you look at the guidelines, or certainly the guidelines in South Africa, what we find is this, that they have been downloaded from the CDC, because the CDC guidelines are very widely available, and indeed they should be, and they are completely inappropriate. The problems in the industrialized countries are not those of Africa, because the infrastructure is totally different. The background is different. The guidelines and policies do not apply. And therefore, what we need to know very clearly is that we look at the principles, but not necessarily the practice. And I'd like to take you through this, because it's quite important. In South Africa, we have 1,000 per 100,000 population. In the United States, they have 5 per 100,000 population. And therefore, all of us are exposed. In fact, I'm sure I'm carrying loads of tuberculosis myself. But if we weren't, then that meant that you weren't working in a clinical environment. Okay, I think this is a controversial thing, but the infecting load from some of the work done by Riley was that it's about 50 infectious particles, and it becomes quite apparent to us that we've got to look at these aspects. In the United States, they have low exposure rates. You guys see one in eight months, 9 months. We see 30 cases a day. The load is different. Okay, and obviously the co-infection is very high. And I would imagine if you do find somebody with tuberculosis, you probably would investigate them into the extent to find out what's going on. And we do know that natural ventilation, there's several publications now that suggest natural ventilation can reduce the transmission and the bioburden. Whereas in the United States, I think natural ventilation is not the most approved way of doing things. We're looking at mechanical ventilation. However, you do have very well-maintained engineering departments, and indeed associate professors in engineering, who will advise you on ventilation. We have an odd person that's wandering around usually with a spanner and a wrench, and he tells you what he thinks is a good idea at the time. UV light is being used, and it is being advocated widely, but from our point of view, I don't know whether it's totally appropriate. So, can we look at some of the written plans that are happening? We're looking at the training of counselors dealing with TB and supervision of well-trained staff. We don't know that our training is adequate. We need to make sure we are not screening the workers for tuberculosis. And we're not screening and we're not protecting HIV-positive workers, as you've heard just now from Karen. So I think the implementing of this in the workplace becomes terribly, terribly difficult. And a very, very important part to us in living now in Africa is that the hospital is a natural extension of the home. Every person who comes into hospital will be visited by the family and they will have a caregiver, whether you like it or not. You can't exclude them because that is the culture. And if you don't include them in your TB program, it is doomed for failure. If you do not bring in the people from the community as a high priority, you're really doomed for failure. I'm going to just go through some more very quickly because I realize I'm actually, even though I was a bit delayed, the local exhaust ventilations are in all areas. If we did that for the Western Cape, we'd have to have that entirely in the entire health facilities of our hospitals. Exhaust ventilations we cannot maintain because we haven't got what it takes, and we don't know that UV lights actually work. And we certainly have seen a lot of disused, misused, and abused UV lights sitting around in clinics and places that are quite ineffective. However, there's some wonderful work done by Ron Escobar, who I think is an absolute hero, and looked at the fact that natural ventilation of 28 air changes an hour versus mechanical ventilation of 12. And using the Wells and Riley module showed that it could actually look at airborne infections occurring 33% in negative rooms and 11% in naturally ventilated rooms. And quite effectively showed this reduction by opening windows. And for those of us that live in Africa and are blessed, it works a treat. This is one of the hospitals I've visited, and you can see this is an MDR ward. The ward's open, there are lots of windows, bed curtains, wide open spaces, people sitting around, and this is a classic situation. Nobody sits, comes to hospital on their own. So when you're isolating a patient, you're always isolating them with members of family. And the caregivers are therefore, have always been given instruction. We have a very strong caregiver instruction program, making sure that the windows are open, that there's a lot of sunlight, because we have a lot of that, thank you. And there are precautions, the same precautions for the healthcare workers as for the caregivers when they're tending the family. And the last run, which I'd like to just go through very quickly, is about the respiratory masks. It is suggested that surgical masks are inadequate for TB, and the N95 equivalent are used with well-fitted face shields and respiratory check. Now, if we did this, we'd all have to be wearing masks the whole time while we're working in hospital. And what we've therefore recommended is that they use surgical masks for patients, N95 respirators, because there's terrible confusion about the N95. I mean, I've had seen patients who've got this duckbill mask, they've got a chest drain, and they're lifting it up and smoking while they're standing outside. So it sort of defeats the purpose, really, a little bit. You know. I've also seen a three-year-old with a mask hung around the bottom of her face, looking up like that, wondering where she was. So we have to put this thing into perspective, and we have to make sure we understand what's happening. We have also suggested that they use bed curtains around patients who are bed-bound and cannot get up to produce sputum, and if they're going to cough, that those remain closed for 10 minutes or so before they're opened again. And there's a whole protocol now established for the collection of sputum, both induced and not induced. Cough rooms is a, I don't know if it's actually a South African thing, but it's actually quite a good thing because they've got this thing where they have cough rooms. However, they're not usually exhaust ventilated. And we have great, great problems with engineering maintenance. So I just wanted to make this point, and I'd like to do this rather quickly. If one coughs, you're looking at a 3-meter movement. If you use a hanky, we can detect these droplets at 0.5. And if one uses a surgical mask, it's also at 0.5. However, if there's an aerosol issue, you're probably looking at 2 meters. With a hanky, you come down to 1 meter, and we realize that with the mask, you can bring it down to 0.25 meters. And the reason we have to do these demonstrations is while we know what we can send out, at the moment the GH line is actually discussing, what do you inhale? If the other guy is just coughing at you and you're wearing a mask, how much protection is that? And that apparently, if I'm not mistaken, is about 80%. And even if you've got the best fitting mask, and for those people that live in countries where they have, their physical features are not Roman, there's a massive gap between their nose and the top. And that is true a lot of Africa and a lot of Asia. So what do you land up with? You land up with big holes on top, and you cannot really get a proper fit testing done. So maybe they need to have a bit of something done to modify it. And what I was just again going to make the point is that all this equipment has been geared towards a market which is not where all the disease is. I just want to go back and talk about the cough etiquette. We at the moment are doing some studies looking at the reduction of infectious particles where possible. These small confined spaces where people go into cough, we now make sure that all of them have got ventilation going on. Sometimes patients are nebulized and the staff really are at risk. We are now also involved with the design. This is an absolutely fantastic clinic. You walk in there, and the first thing that's asked of you is, are you here, do you have a cough or not? And it doesn't have to be 3 weeks, and no. Do you have a cough? The guy says, yeah, okay, well, can you go to that side, please? Okay. And they come in and say, have you not been, you haven't got a cough, okay, well, you hang around here, and mum and children will hang around on this side. So it's a quadrangle in the middle. I don't know what he's doing up there, but anyway. there's a quadrangle in the middle, and there's a clinic, and this side is a clinic. And it's really well designed, because there's constant air movement. I mean, if people didn't wear masks, it was fine. You know, they didn't have to be terrified of it. And again, talking about an area where they went off to sit outside, or if they needed to go and collect sputum, they had a separate area. And I think that's really clever stuff. Now that was done locally, basically, and when the principle was given to them, they applied it into practice, and to me that was a really important thing. So very quickly, this is my last slide, thank you, or my penultimate slide. We need simple and very easy to implement guidelines. Massive documents scare everybody, including me. We're very clear that we want ventilation to happen, whether it happens naturally or otherwise. And if it is mechanical, it needs to be exhausted. And in fact, our new pediatric unit is now going to be totally under negative exhaust ventilation. How are we going to maintain it, of course, is another matter. We have to make sure that we have proper procurement of protective clothing. The knowledge and training of healthcare workers and the community must be included. And I think a lot of collaborative programs across Africa, which help to build capacity. And to the end of trying to build capacity, this is the new Infection Prevention and Control Africa network, which we started earlier this year. We have 17 member countries working on various programs. We've got loads and loads of support. And for those of you who want to come and see us, you're more than welcome to come to Uganda next year in 2009. I thank you very much for your patience. I'd be very surprised if you didn't have a question.
Yeah. What happens when the windows are closed in cold weather?
Yeah. Can I tell you something we're trying at the moment, and I don't want to really talk about it otherwise. What we realize is that hot air rises. So what we've actually done is all the windows at the bottom are closed and the heating systems are put on at the bottom. Okay. And we have now followed the air currents, and we can see the air currents rising and going out the top because our window systems established as double. We don't have the sort of very modern American hospitals. We've got the old sort of fever wards, if you like. So they've got double windows. So the bottom ones are closed and the top are. That is one thing we're trying. And I'll tell you about it when we finish the work. The second issue is that if they are cold, then they are going to have a lot of problem with transmission. You're absolutely right. And we would like to then see exhaust ventilation in those areas, if we can. So we'd probably try and run the exhaust ventilation for the winter, if we can, and maintain it during the summer all the time to make sure that the filters are working and that we've got the air systems working. But most importantly, the particulate count. We're having big problems with particulate count.
Any other burning questions? Yes, please. I think I probably made a microphone, sorry.
You'll pick up as many as you want.
Yeah, my name is Helen Cox. I'm from NSF. Decentralized MDR TB care project in Kailicha.
I know you do. Yeah. Excellent, it is too.
So I have two points to make. The first is that you pointed out the proportion of MDR DRTB is quite low in Africa from the WHO. But I actually think that that's probably not the best way to look at it. If
right.
you compare the estimated MDR TB incidence by yeah. population, South Africa is actually higher than Russia. So in terms of infection control in health facilities and in the community, you've got an even worse problem.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think we were very, sort of, we were very complacent about looking at WHO data. No, that's fine. But we see, we have the Khayelitsha Hospital outpatient in our hospital, and I know how much tuberculosis we've got, and we've just had the whole place had to revamp because of the various issues that are going on. But more importantly, I want them out of the hospital. So I really need people in Khayelitsha to understand that they're going to be taking this. The other thing I don't understand why they have to be 18 months.
Well,
because to me...
Actually my second point about the contrast between your presentation and the first one about the forced hospitalization of all patients. We're trying very hard to treat them in the community because...
Absolutely, I agree. Absolutely.
Because around South Africa, there is 40% default rate on DRTB treatment, mainly caused by forced hospitalization.
Well, apart from that, you see, the point is that from a public health, according to the Public Health Act of 2003, you may incarcerate somebody. But according to the Human Rights Act, you don't have to treat them. So you could, the guy could lie there till he had family, and he had children. And I mean, he would not need to be treated. But if you see the way they've been incarcerated, you will understand why there's a problem. There are bare walls. There's nothing in there. And this poor chap is sitting there staring at a wall, usually wearing a mask for some stupid reason, and is thinking about how he's going to cope with his family and how he's going to feed the family. And I think the real problem is that if you brought in the family and the groups that we have worked with where the whole family gets involved in the treatment because it's their livelihood, I mean, there's no reason why we can't. I don't know why we have to incarcerate them for that length of time, because most people become quite non-infectious in the first 3 months of treatment, appropriate treatment.
Do totally agree.
All right. Thank you to everyone. I know that this has stimulated a lot of questions and thoughts, but we are already 15 minutes over our time, so I'm hoping that you can continue your discussions and ask your questions after we adjourn. And I just want to say thank you to all of our speakers for their wonderful presentations. Everyone's